Welcome to The Writing Life, the podcast for anyone who writes. I'm Holly, Head of Programs and Creative Engagement at the National Centre for Writing, here at Dragon Hall in Norwich, UNESCO City of Literature. We have a real treat in store for you today. In this episode of The Writing Life, NCW's Communications Assistant Molly speaks to author Naomi Wood about writing subversive women. Naomi Wood is the award-winning author of three novels, including the best-selling Mrs. Hemingway. Her stories have been published in the Mid-American Review, Washington Square Review, Joyland, and Stylist. They've been shortlisted for the Manchester Fiction Prize, the London Magazine Short Story Prize, and longlisted for the Galley Beggar Press Story Prize. Her recent short story, Comorbidities, won the 2023 BBC National Short Story Award. Molly and Naomi discuss writing subversive, malicious women in Naomi's debut short story collection, This Is Why We Can't Have Nice Things, published in April 2024. They speak about themes of motherhood, family connections, and perceptions of pregnant women, and how to craft a range of different voices in short story writing. So now, I'm very excited to hand over to Molly in conversation with Naomi Wood.
Okay, so welcome to The Writing Life, Naomi. It's lovely to have you on.
Thank you, Molly.
Yeah, I'm really excited to chat about This Is Why We Can't Have Nice Things, your short story collection, about writing these sort of subversive women and also writing shorter fiction as well. I was wondering if, to start us off, you could maybe talk about the collection as a whole and some of your inspirations behind it.
Yeah, I'm keen to say it's anti-autobiographical, but no one would believe me, I think. Yeah, it's about This Is Why We Can't Have Nice Things, which is coming out in April with Orion, is about a group of, how I have termed them, sort of charmingly toxic women who follow their bad energy. That's the major link, I think, through the whole collection, that the women sort of follow their own bad energy. And I think the inspiration behind the collection is a sort of impulse or kickback inside myself, which is like, you know, I think a lot of women are like constantly trying to be nice all the time and like care for each other and care for everyone. And this is almost like therapy to write about women resisting that impulse. And, you know, when you have a impulse to say something awful or destructive, or you have an impulse that is taking you toward a path that feels unorthodox or resistant to what society wants you to do. And these women do it. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it's awful. Sometimes it's kind of glorious, like in Comorbidities. Mm-hmm. They do something transgressive, because I suppose parents aren't meant to make a sex tape while the kids are at granny's. And then sometimes, yeah, it's very destructive, like in Dracula, the movies, one of the stories. The director is a sort of like Me Too-able female director who is caught in the same sort of female idolatry that a male director would be. So they're a network of pretty shitty ladies who have hopefully richly interesting as to why they're behaving like that. They're kind of like the women we're not allowed to be, but we sometimes fantasize about being. Is that really revealing of my pathology, psychopathology?
No, I love it. And I think it was just absolutely fascinating to see the different tropes of characters. And I thought on Wedding Day in particular, I really loved the main protagonist and sort of really enjoyed her completely sort of vengeful feelings towards Nick and Esther. I loved the way you wrote that, and I wonder if you could speak a little bit about that story.
Yeah, she's one of the worst.
Yeah.
Well done, Molly, for revealing that. That was really interesting because that story, I feel like tonally, is quite different from the other nine stories. Mm-hmm. The other eight are meant to be quite funny. Mm-hmm. That one doesn't have much humor in it. But I wrote it in the summer where I discovered Betty Howland, who was a Chicago-based short story writer. She's really dense in a, like, kind of quite Saul Bellow way. Really compelling, really. Her observations are just like, wow. And I think I was somewhat ventriloquizing Betty Howland when I wrote it. And It was kind of a story of like, so your ex is getting married. How can you destroy it but seem civilized? And she can't get to the wedding, but her daughter can, who is, it's in a time of COVID. She is the bridesmaid at the wedding. And the narrator, who I don't think has a name. Our nameless narrator concocts a sort of condition to say, okay, because she's resistant to her daughter Paola being the bridesmaid. She says, okay, I'll give in if you, Nick, my ex, return her. And we kind of don't know for the whole story, like, what she's going to do. But the sexual connection between Nick and the narrator is so strong that we know it will overspill, and that his connection to Esther, the new wife, in a sexual way, maybe not in the other realms, is not as strong. So she knows she's going to weaponize it. And, yeah, vengeful is completely the right word. She enacts revenge on Nick and Esther, and she's satisfied with the revenge, I think. But she's also the one living with privation. She's the one living with less and a lack. So the satisfaction is only on that day, I would say. It was really fun to write because she's pretty, she's without compunction or much guilt about what she's going to do.
Yeah.
She enacts that plan.
Yeah, I definitely think you can feel that sort of enjoyment, especially, you know, saying that she's going in for the kill, saying that she's, you know, kind of almost brought to that point by having been sort of, she says at one point, she's sort of been a good woman up until now. And now she's sort of, I guess there's a freedom in being able to just not care about other people, but sort of act on her own impulses.
Yeah, and what's buried in the story, or is somewhat concealed, is the backstory, which happened to, you know, a lot of, like, single mothers I knew during COVID, which was, like, they're just stuck with the baby and the kid and the job, and the dad wasn't there. And they had 2 years of suddenly becoming not just sole carer, but sole carer without school, without after-school clubs, without all of the infrastructure that means that you can keep going and earn money and go to your job. So they've had a year and a half of COVID. Maybe it's in the summer that he remarries. And she has been sole parent to the child, to Paola. And so it's not without reason that she enacts this plan. You know, she's like, she's been good for long enough.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. And you can really feel that kind of raw pain because he left so soon after her birth and the massive weight that sort of had. And, you know, you completely, at least I completely could empathise with her anger. And I think there's a lot of, you carve out a lot of space for angry, indignant women who, you know, are really just finding different ways to cope with motherhood, but particularly people's perceptions of motherhood and how they have been treated. I wondered if you could talk about that space.
Yeah, I think, what unites the collection as well is that the protagonists tend to be mothers, or they are expectant mothers. And I think I didn't really experience sexism, or I felt like I didn't, until I became pregnant for the first time around and then the second time around. And I was like, oh my God, what is this shit?
Yeah.
You know, my privilege meant I maybe sailed through other situations that, like, other women would have been definitely caught up in. And then I just found, like, when I got pregnant and then when I became a mum, that, like, there was such a, like, a normative way of being that tended to be quite, well, there's two ways, I think, which I find super interesting, is that, like, there was a sort of attachment-style parenting, very sentimental, very emotionally attuned to the baby and putting the baby first and then you're second. So, and then what I did in reaction to that was that, like, I did what I call performative negativity, where I was like, I hated that so much. It triggered something in me psychotherapeutically that I would pretend to be negligent or pretend to be like, oh, I hate them, or like, oh, the baby's playing with the hair straighteners type thing. And like, because there was no moderate way to be, there was like no authentic or just not, I felt like I couldn't, and I didn't feel like the supercharged end of positivity or the supercharged end of negativity, really. Mm-hmm. It was like something in the middle or a mix of those feelings. Mm-hmm. And what was so hard was ever trying to be like congruent or like authentic with just feeling like ambivalent a lot of the time, or super positive and then the next minute super negative. So kind of forgotten your original question, but these women in these stories, hopefully they express something real that is not commodified by, like, culture. And it's really difficult right now because society and culture has just these ways that they want women to be. And I found it particularly egregious in motherhood. And these women, to full or lesser extent, they're really trying to bust out of those molds, and to, they're allowed to be aggressive and allowed to be angry and allowed to be very boundaried. Mm-hmm. And those are all things I struggle with.
Yeah. And I think that was, yeah, really beautifully expressed as well, because I think in some of the stories, the women who are mothers talk about how much they absolutely adore the children, while also, you know, acknowledging how exhausting raising a child is, how, you know, it takes different parts of yourselves, the feeling of being pregnant and kind of those emotions all wrapped up into one. And, you know, also with the external idea that you need to be constantly sort of really overwhelmingly blissful and happy. And I think lesbian therapy in particular was one where that is sort of explored, the different wanting to resist the different expectations of how you should be coming back to work or of how you should be post-pregnancy. And I think it was really interesting seeing Leslie and Irina's interactions. And yeah, seeing how Leslie had struggled but didn't want to, wanted to seem completely put together in this therapy group.
She's entrenched in a huge amount of pain. And she's, so the, yeah, that story is, that is autobiographical. I went to a post-maternity leave group at UEA, and I thought it was going to be about, like, I don't know, like, finances or, like, what are your rights and practical suggestions. And then it was, like, more like a kind of, like, therapy group, and I was like, oh, man, what am I doing here? And instead of being able to accept and integrate the care that was being shown for me, I was, like, I was not Leslie, I was not deeply problematic, but I was very resistant internally to receiving other women's care. And I thought that was such an interesting place to start from. So Leslie in that story is co-opted into sort of a corporate therapy session for returning parents, but, you know, it's only the mums. And she is deeply attached to the anti-mother Leslie in the corporate workspace, who is chic and stylish and implacable and persuasive and effective, the non-mother. And then the mother is brought into that space, into her corporate space, and she sees it as a kind of poisoning, as a kind of toxicity in the workplace. It has poisoned her safe space away from children and motherhood. And we realize, you know, she's had two goes of postnatal depression, that her problems are so much deeper than a, like, corporate meditation session can even touch. And Irina, her old friend, is now on that polar opposite of being positive, being loving with her children and enjoying it. There's nothing wrong with Irina. It's just that the different techniques of parenthood have set them so far apart that now they can't even talk to each other. And it's such a sadness in in the story. And it originates really with Leslie. Okay, there's a little bit on Irina's side, but, like, that inability to understand that there can be two perspectives and that there's no need to be destructive toward the positive is, she's paralyzed, I think. And she's under the false notion that, like, work is going to save her, and it can't.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting to read about, because it became really clear as I was reading how much pain she was in and how difficult she was finding that. And obviously, you know, lashing out and throwing the pen and kind of...
Yeah, she assaults the counselor.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a soft assault. She throws a pen at her head, but I think it would be chalked down as a sort of attack.
Yeah. Yeah. And kind of the difficulty that she finds in that space, and kind of not, I think it kind of made me think a lot about sort of therapy spaces and how they can make people feel, especially in a group setting. And she sort of wonders at the therapist's salary or how much she's getting paid, and tries deliberately to sort of disrupt things. And I think throughout sort of different stories in your collection, there are women who are trying to disrupt, whether it's parts of the status quo or disrupt parts of their lives. And I thought one of the stories that really stayed with me was Dracula in the movies. I was really sort of captivated and also horrified by Ray's obsession with Ivy and trying to sort of invoke different acting styles by sort of talking about her dead twin and talking about the actress in a very possessive way. And I thought you could maybe talk a little bit about this character and kind of her very malign intentions there.
Yeah, I think so Dracula at the movies portrays, I don't know if that's the adjective, but a sort of Me Too director, or a director who should be Me Too, but she happens to be a woman. And I think part of our humanity is to accept the fact that, like, women can be the ultimate persecutors as well as men in a patriarchy. And Ray, in this very male-dominated world, has taken on a lot of attributes that are really problematic. And we realize she's sort of oppressed by her friend Vasily, who I think we all recognize as that, like, dude who's doing really well and it seems to be effortless, and it just, like, stirs her anger and envy no end. Vasily is not the cause of her pathology. She doesn't see it as problematic, her relationship with Ivy. She's willing to exploit the trauma of her past, of Ivy's past, to get a better scene, to get a better take. Lots of directors I've talked to have admitted doing that. To me, it does seem quite dubious. I don't know whether that actor knows it's happening. Anyways, hopefully in that story, you follow this journey where you're quite on Ray's side maybe in the beginning, and then she becomes more and more unreliable in terms of how much, I guess, we like her or trust her, and we realize that this woman, Ivy, who is, again, a person deeply in pain, addiction issues, trauma from having lost her twin. Maybe there's a relationship to why she's lost the twin, some guilt. And Ray is just completely willing to trade on it. And the story is really about Ivy's attempt to reclaim herself away from the grip of this vampire who's willing to suck all the blood out of her to get what she wants. And again, it's about a sort of militancy of like, my career is the only thing that matters. And men, women, whoever will get in the way. You know, she's willing to use her like unborn child as a prop or a weapon in this plot of revenge. So yeah, I said maybe Wedding Day narrator was the worst, but maybe she's pretty awful. I wonder if she's without morals or whether she, her compass is only set to one point, and she's, I think she thinks she's a good person, but maybe that, so yeah, Dracula in Movies was really like an attempt to kind of like dig into Me Too a little bit to see, you know, it's like that film Tar, have you seen, with Cate Blanchett? She's a virtuoso conductor. And it was originally written for a man, and she's got deeply problematic relationships with her students. And I think it's way more interesting that she's a woman and that she's, like, being dodgy, being like, this is not okay. Like, you're trading on your power and, like, you're exploiting people and you're in a position of power and this student isn't. You're a gatekeeper to a world of money and success and privilege. So it's interesting, I think, to think about women as just as capable as men of being in this situation. So often I think the women in the stories have relinquished their victimhood, but in the move away from that, they've taken on oppression and mastery too quickly. Like Suzette in the story Hurt Feelings, you know, she's this female boss who's just like terrible, and self-serving, and it's like I think maybe. This is my first interview about this collection, so I'm really enjoying exploring what are the themes, because I don't think I've articulated them out loud. You know, in Hurt Feelings, there is that sense of like, or in the whole collection, actually, there's a sense of like people have abandoned the goodness side of women, and then they've like really too quickly hopped over to like oppression, aggression, squashing other people in order to like get what they want. So... And maybe that just feels like the difficulty, the trickiness of feminism, where it's like we're still, it's hard just to be in the middle.
Yeah, definitely. And vying for a, you know, vying for power in that way. But getting that power also means, as you said, sort of taking, oppressing other people. You know, it's manifested in that way in some of these stories. And I was just thinking of Suzette as you were talking, because she really... speaks to Claudia in quite a quite an atrocious way, and talks about things in a very sort of transactional sense in particular. And I think it's interesting thinking about the different power dynamics, because you've got whole, just such a cast of characters. And I wondered if you, well, how you found it to write about the sort of shifting power dynamics and about such a wide range of different characters as well.
I think I wanted to write for the first time. I mean, this collection is really quite different in terms of tone and style from what I usually, how I usually write, because I had been writing historical fiction, and over the pandemic, I think you know this writer, I discovered Jenny Zhang, and she really just absolutely enlivened me to a way of writing that was like conversational, full of slang, very like what you might say like low register, aggressive, full of obscenity. And I was like, oh my God, I didn't know you could write like this. It was a real like epiphany moment for me. And I wanted to write, and I didn't intend to write a short story collection. It was just the pandemic and the kids were at home and I had very, very, very little time. And I had to do something that was manageable. But I was also interested in the way dynamics at work played out for me when I was pregnant, and then when I came back to work, and the slipperiness of what you're allowed to expect and what you get and what people promise. And, you know, everybody's like very sensitive to what they're meant to say. I'm doing finger quotes. And then the reality of how things happen is very different. So I wanted to, I thought like the dynamics of like corporate workspace is really interesting. And, you know, just because a woman like Suzette has been through, you know, we know she's got two daughters, she's been through pregnancy, she's been through trying to manage work and also being in a high risk pregnancy, like which I don't think I was high risk, but I had the same problems as, as Claudia, which means you're in and out of more appointments and, you know, you're pissing people off, but also you can't help it. But you also can't help feeling guilty because other people are mopping up your work and they can't help resenting you because they're having to do more. So it's somewhat impossible. But yeah, with Suzette, it's like she has been through it and yet she has no sympathy for somebody going through it, maybe in a more shambolic or more intensive way. So there's a really interesting book by Jacqueline Rose called Mothers, which is about like the problematic visibility of the pregnant person. And it's just, it's very interesting that when you become pregnant, I found was that like, I hated that visibility. I hated like everybody knowing something super private about myself. And like, suddenly you were a top, that was the topic of conversation, like almost like constantly, even at work, you just really couldn't escape it. So pregnancy at work, I guess, is a theme of Leslie in therapy and Dracula at the movies and hurt feelings. And I guess peekaboo. They're all dealing, I guess, with how visible they feel and maybe how uncared for they are. And especially, I guess, in Hurt Feelings, where it's obviously a really rich advertising agency. I mean, she takes care of no one. Like, the only black creative at the agency has been fired. She is very unsure about whether she's going to be able to come back from maternity leave into her position. Her partner's a dick. there is resources in that company to look after people and they don't. So it's just such a weird alien experience I found, like being pregnant in the world today. And it really cut me off from a very accepted sense of invisibility an anonymity that I didn't even know I had.
Yeah.
So in some ways it was really helpful because I was like, oh, this sucks. Being in this body sucks right now. And other people don't feel like that, definitely. They really enjoy pregnancy. But I, yeah, it was an interesting experience. And obviously I've translated all of those feelings into many of the stories.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's, yeah, just really fascinating. It was really moving in the stories how people interacted with the main protagonists and how they were viewed, as you were saying, particularly in Hurt Feelings and in Peekaboo. And I think particularly in Peekaboo, it was kind of dealing with family dynamics. And I thought that was really interesting. And again, with twins as well. And that really, really struck me, the relationship between the father and the daughter and sort of her coming to terms with that pain. And I was wondering if you could talk about the bond between those two characters and how that kind of parent-child dynamic worked there in a different sense.
Yeah, that's very I was really stuck, and I wanted to write something and I didn't have an idea. Mm. So I went on a plot generator.
I love that.
I was like, you know, you sometimes have the impulse to write because it can feel good, can feel wretched. So I went on this plot generator, and I think it was something like, you know, it's like those like insane AI generated one sentences, and it was like somebody commits a fraud abroad or something. So I thought, and I was unsure for a lot of the time whether like my uncle had a timeshare, and I was like, would this work? I don't know how I came up with the idea of the timeshare, but yeah, so the plot generator started off that story. And I was interested in the idea of like twin pregnancies. Just seemed like such a funny idea, like, and everybody thinking like, are the kids going to be twins? And just getting everything wrong, and like it being COVID, and then the twins in that story being this kind of like magical phantasm almost of like, oh, you're identical twins and you're both pregnant at the same time. And like how people found that like totally trippy in a way that like it's actually not that interesting. But for them, it became this like magical intervention in a pandemic in which like it was just like violent grief for a lot of people. It's just awful, wall-to-wall awfulness. They were this kind of like almost like intervention, as a sense of the fairy tale. Yeah, that story is based on Annie and her dad, who the dad is an alcoholic, possibly with maybe a bipolar diagnosis. And he's charming to many people and can get what he wants. And then the drinking goes too far, becomes a binge, and it becomes deeply problematic. And he decides to, he's got a kind of penthouse timeshare in Italy, and he decides to barricade himself in and not let the new people into the timeshare. And Annie decides she's going to fly out with her twin to spring him from the apartment and sort everything out. And again, I think she is a woman who is over-resilient. So she looks after a lot of men in her life. And I think she's expecting a boy. I think she knows that. And she acts pretty quickly to go out there. She says, I know how to do this. I know how to spring daddy from this apartment. And the twin is much more detached and, but also much more cognitive of how the dad exploits her need to care and trades on it. And maybe she knows that already, but it comes to her awareness on this. It's kind of a holiday. It's kind of a rescue mission to a place called Riccione in northern Italy. And I mean, I don't want those stories to sound like full of pain because they're meant to be quite funny, but I guess pain is an underlying, there is a tank of pain in a lot of these stories. And she, you know, she keeps on trying to access him. She keeps on trying to find him. And that's a physical thing and an emotional thing. And he has literally kind of like locked the door and won't come out of the door, apart from the spy hole in the door. And she's trying to get him to open the door. And she can't. And she can't open the door to him. And she can't get him to act as a father to her because she's too busy mothering him. But in a way, the trajectory of that story is positive because the story ends with a group of women. And there's a kind of throwing off of responsibility to the men in her life, her boss, her dad, the ex-boyfriend or the boyfriend who may or may not be on the scene, the dad of the child. And there's a kind of move toward women, which is really empowering for her. There will be no wedding. The wedding is someone else's in that group. But there's a kind of a detachment from the dad and then a reattachment toward womanhood. I don't want to kind of give it away too much, but she leaves her dad behind the door and it's all she can do. She can't get him out. And he is ultimately an adult who can look after himself.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that's a really, really lovely story in terms of, as you said, with that humour, but also with that difficulty and Annie constantly, you know, being a personal assistant, looking after other people, kind of falling into that role of caring, but hopefully beginning to sort of break out of that cycle and realise that, you know, she can't mother her dad in that way.
I think she ends the story with some boundaries. I think, you know, modern therapeutic speak, I think she hangs up the phone on her boss. She leaves the dad behind the door. And I think she's established some boundaries.
Definitely. And I think you write so candidly and poignantly about connections between women as well. And I really enjoyed reading and I enjoyed kind of seeing the relationship between Stacey and
Marissa.
Stacey and Marissa kind of build as the journey goes on, and kind of thinking that, you know, she's been stuck in this pattern with Gail and hopefully will begin to move on and the both of them can support each other. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about connections between women in some of your stories.
I think, well, like, I don't know, female friendship is like insanely delicious, complicated, but you know, there's nothing like it, is there? It's just like, oh, I'm so lucky to have my friends, you know? And I think in the stories, Yeah, I think specifically in that story, I guess it is about female friendship, although I kind of did imagine it a little bit like an aunt. There is an age gap between Marissa and Stacey. Marissa's certainly maternal toward her and caring. Mm. There is an aunt-like relationship there. But I think, yeah, that's quite, it's another kind of like, kind of more positive story than something like Dracula in terms of like, she has had a great wrong done to her in this story. It's a story of separation between a man and a woman, but it's complicated and tricky. She finds out a secret when she travels to Paris so that Marissa's cat can have its eyes fixed. This so constantly good. Crying cat needs its tubes fixed in the veterinarian clinic in Paris. And while she's in Paris, she discovers something untoward about Gael and his behaviour there. But it's Marissa, you know, because I think the story could have ended at the secret.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't. And I think it's Marissa who pulls her out of despondency and hopelessness and empowers or emboldens Stacey to be a person on her own and a person for whom things like that needn't happen to, grammar. And I think their friendship is kind of, I don't know, like laudable or enviable. There is that age discrepancy. There's also a wealth discrepancy and there's some feelings going on there intergenerationally. But I think there is also like huge support and I mean, I don't want it to sound too cheesy, but like, yeah, mutual empowerment, I guess, because Stacey also helps Marissa cleave away from her ex to get her own finances in order to make a will. So, yeah, I didn't really see it like that, but it's interesting because maybe it is like a buddy movie, you know, like a road trip. They go on a road trip together and they fall out and they make up. And yeah, it's about friendship. Yeah. That's interesting. I thought it was more about the relationship with the ex, but maybe it's, maybe the story is predicated on that friendship actually.
I thought it was really interesting how their journeys sort of paralleled each other and how they seemed to be, you know, both going through interesting sort of relationships as well. And I felt the characters pull towards Gael, and I feel that the story was around, you know, centered around that, but I also felt like the two of them sort of traveled through that together. And I was wondering if we could segue into talking a little bit about structure and how you found sort of writing short stories, how you went about that, and how you might have found that sort of reflected some of the themes in your collection.
Yeah, oh, short story structure. Well, I started writing short stories when I started writing, and I was 24 when I started, 23 when I started writing. 17 years ago. I was like, interesting. They keep on failing in a way that, like, when you're writing long form, you can't see the failure as egregiously. But I kept on trying to write these stories and being like, I was very cognizant that, like, something very key was failing in a, like, non-negotiable way, not as in like, oh, my sentences could improve or my style could improve or my characterization could improve, like something like fundamentally was wrong. And as a teacher of creative writing, like, I don't know, you don't usually say things are like wrong, but I was aware that I didn't understand something. So as I was saying before, like in the pandemic, I started reading Jenny Zhang, Sour Heart, her collection, which I just find mind-blowing. And I was like, huh. And then I just started reading, but really intensively, short stories in a way I hadn't before. Like I'd read classics, I'd read short stories, but I wasn't in the habit of reading short story collections. And then I read short story collections for maybe about 2 or 3 years. And I don't think I read a novel. And I understood, I understood intuitively, and maybe I'm not sure if I can articulate it, that I was doing something wrong with structure. That I was trying to do too much. The events were too big. And Laurie Moore says, you know, the short story is interested in tiny vibrations at the window, a rattling of the window. The novel is interested in, I don't know, that analogy, the burning down of the house, right? I think I was trying to burn down the house. And then, and so I think the short story as a structure wants to be about one thing or one or two things. It can't be encyclopedic or compendious. It needs to be very streamlined. Sometimes I think it can take just like five beats, five scenes that can make a whole story. There's something about the form which is really, really difficult. This is kind of maybe a bit cliche, but like you have to hit your marks. There's no yield in a novel. You could maybe have some boring chapters, slightly slower subplot. In a short story, everything needs to be lined up and everything needs to be streamlined and as slim and as it needs to do its job very economically. And I think it was only after writing three novels that I worked out how to do the short story. But I still don't really know how. So my friend Andrew Cowan, who works at UEA with me, he did a really intensive edit of these stories, and we'd meet up for a coffee and he'd say, okay, so what is this about? And I'd say, I think it's about this. And he'd say, no, it's about that. And I think I've got a lot better at the structure and form of writing short stories, but I still give him my stories and I think, okay, now he's going to say, yeah, you've nailed it. And he still goes, no. this is the arc. So I'm still getting to grips with like how to, but I think most writers can't articulate this, the like precise problematics of why short stories are so much more difficult in terms of structure than the long form. They're so tricky and difficult and like ultimately completely satisfying. But the structure is, the storytelling is very exacting and hard and exposing. Like, I feel like if you get that wrong, it's just like you're on a road to nowhere. So many short stories have ended in the bin because I just haven't been able to like nail them down.
It's such a tricky thing to write. And so, you know, I feel like there's so much that you could choose to include or choose to, like you say, there's no room for any sort of superfluous sort of writing. You have to really fine tune what you want to, what story you want to tell.
And then you have to try and end it.
Yeah.
And the ending is like more impossible than the rest of it. And usually the ending has gone wrong because you're not sure what question you're asking of the short story. And therefore, it's not the ending that's wrong. It's the beginning and middle because you haven't prepared the reader for that specific ending. So even with like the best short stories, you watch the author try and end it and you're like, oh, you don't know where this should end. I don't know where this should end. I totally forgive you for writing a kind of dud ending because, like, who knows? Yeah. Andrew knows where what that ending should have been. But, yeah, endings are just, oh. It's like trying to land an airplane on, like, I don't know, a country road.
It would be great to touch a bit on comorbidities and also congratulate you on winning the BBC National Short Story Award. Just an amazing achievement and a really incredible, funny, interesting story about intimacy, about family. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about that and also how you found writing it.
It was just such a delight to win. I feel like probably the biggest prize I've ever won in my career, and to be recognised for short stories was particularly touching. I'm not a stranger to a shortlist, but I never win. So it was like so delightful. Comorbidities is about intimacy, about building intimacy even in exhaustion. How to find intimacy when you have two children who are completely reliant on you for every single need, and how not to lose your relationship in the thick of that. And what was so nice about this story was that Mackenzie and Mason, they really love each other. And they're finding it very, very hard, very tough. And they decide to spice up their relationship by making a sex tape. They've had a fruity past. They've had a kind of, she describes it as kind of sexy and lurid. So this isn't out of character for them, but it's out of character for their lives, I guess. And it, I was talking to my editor and she was saying, God, it feels transgressive just to even have sex, you know, with the kids in the house. So they're making a sex tape. The kids aren't in the house. It feels pretty kind of like transgressive. But it was such a fun experience to write that story because... Andrew described it as like a cluster of tensions because it has this kind of spiral structure. And she spirals around lots of anxieties like the internet and the digitalization of our lives and like porn and scary things being on the internet, and the internet being like kind of slimy and gross and also like wondrous and kind of joyous. And about gender and about breastfeeding and about climate change. So it's just so fun to write something about all the anxieties like I have to weave everything in was difficult because it does take on quite a lot of themes, which is like in direct contrast to me saying like the story has to be about one thing. That story is about like quite a lot of things. And the interesting thing with that story is that, like, it doesn't really go anywhere. It's all of the problems are sort of unresolved by the end, and there's no arc. But there is, I think, a recalibration of the relationship. I feel like it's a hopeful story, even while, like, she's cognizant that, like, the world is burning. That the intimacy she has, which feels almost like merge with the children, that like she feels like they're still part of them and sorry, they're still part of her. And there's this sort of like existential merge with the children. And then there's this kind of merge intimacy with her husband. And it's like, I think quite hopeful in terms of like the fact that like experience gets shared and that like the individuals break down. All the boundaries of individuals get broken down in a very like meaningful way, that they are as a family a sort of ontological unit. But then there's the fear of like climate change and the world. So it does feel like this little family, like, pitted against environmental catastrophe, which in some ways she can do nothing about. But it also came out of my experience growing up in Hong Kong. The characters, most of the characters are Chinese. She is a white woman. The characters have come over from China and then Hong Kong and then to, I think it's in London. Yeah, it is. And it's about how that family operates cross-culturally, about how she negotiates her husband's job in mental health. And it's one of the stories I'm most proud of, I think. It operates at quite a few levels, and I find that quite satisfying. And I think it's also punchy in its hopefulness, I think.
Yeah, I loved that story. I loved all of them. I think they're just such a strong collection.
Thank you, Molly.
And I just felt like that one was written so artfully and drew lots of different things together. Mason and Mackenzie's relationship in particular, I just loved reading about them and their intimacy, and thought it was filled with hope and also filled with climate anxiety and kind of just trying to find the time for each other. Mm. And I think, as you said, their love for each other was really palpable. Mm. And I loved reading that.
Mm. Yeah, and I think, like, I don't think you need to be a couple of exhausted parents to know that, like, in a long-term relationship, regardless of where you're at in terms of life stage, like, you need to reinvest and build, and things not being spontaneous anymore, and the need to sort of, like, build frameworks into your relationship where you're like, this is when we'll see each other, like, and because you're pulled away from each other so easily. So I think it's just like, I think there's a sense, or I hope there's a sense for readers that, like, whether they had made the sex tape or not, what is reassuring or consoling, I guess, is the move toward each other. Mm. You know, that they try. Mm. And though they feel lots of feelings when the children come back and they're like, we want more. We want more of just looking after each other. And then they feel that bittersweet because she's obsessed with her kids, you know. But there's a feeling of nostalgia for their old selves. And I think you can feel that whether you have children or not, you know, this sense of like, oh, things got really difficult at some point. Mm. Like, when did that happen? So the need, yeah, I think that's the thing, that they go toward reinvesting in each other rather than, like, being pulled apart.
Yeah. Yeah, that's lovely. And I think a really nice note to end on. So just thank you so much.
No, thank you, Molly. As I said, it was my first interview about this book. So it's just so nice to talk about it with someone who's really read it really sensitively. So thank you.
Thank you.
A huge thank you to Molly and Naomi for their time today, and to you for listening. If you have any questions or you want to get in touch, you can find us at Writers' Centre on Twitter and Instagram. We're on Facebook, and you can sign up to the NCW newsletter at nationalcentreforwriting.org.uk. As a UK registered charity, we rely on the generosity of our supporters to make our work possible. You can make a donation over on our website by going to the Support Us page. If you enjoyed what you heard today, please do consider subscribing to the podcast and leaving a rating and a review, because this helps other writers to find us. Thanks again. Keep writing, and I'll catch you on the next episode.